She's a little pumpkin, though. My God, super cute.
We've just got married, and then inevitably the questions start, literally a week later. You know, when are we going to hear the pitter-patter of tiny feet? Are you trying? Do you want children?
Now that Charlie and I are married, we do want to try and have a family.
You know, it's really funny because you spend your entire life trying not to become pregnant, and suddenly everything changes.
Settling down in our late 30s means that falling pregnant isn't something we can take for granted. Around 3.5 million people in the UK have difficulty conceiving a child. And as I'm 38, I'm concerned that I might too.
My main fear is realising too far down the line that it's actually not working.
So I'm on a mission to find out more about fertility. It can be an issue for people of all ages, but these days, more women over 40 are having babies than those under 20. And that's possible because the science of fertility is keeping pace.
So this is where the magic happens.
So I'm going to investigate what pioneering science is doing to help.
This is personalised medicine.
I'll find out how cutting-edge techniques are giving everyone new hope of having children.
Essentially, this is where life was created in this room.
Pretty much.
Even transplants for those born without a womb.
I think it's going to be a routine procedure in 5 to 10 years.
And how we can all keep our eggs and sperm healthy.
Let's get some tests done.
I'm even going to take the plunge to find out how fertile I am.
Oh, wow.
BBC Scotland. Alex Jones, Fertility and Me.
20 seconds.
Yes, can you speak?
Today, we make a lot of choices. Choices about our career, our partner, and when we feel ready to have a baby.
Shadow, the black Labrador. Yes.
And often, that means starting a family later in life. At 38, I'm leaving it later than many, and I'm beginning to wonder about my biological clock. So where better to start than by asking my mother and sister about their experiences of having a family? So I've popped back to Jen's house in Cardiff for a chat and a slice of cake.
In the kitchen.
Most people got married at very early 20s, even at 23. People gave me funny looks as if, oh, she's not getting married until she's 23. I know, they have changed, they have changed.
23 is so young though, isn't it?
Yeah, but obviously you can't do anything until you meet the right man, can you? So
no, it just took me absolute ages.
Yeah.
Fussy.
We had you at 25 and I was considered an old mum then.
Were you?
Yes, at 25.
Mm. Wow.
But I'd always planned to have my children before I was 30.
Right. Mm. What about you then, Jem? So you were 31... when you fell pregnant with Dash, then.
Yeah.
What about conceiving Indy then? Was that a plan? Was it a choice?
It has been fairly quickly.
That happened quite easily then?
Easy peasy. Yes, but, you know, for all sorts of reasons, you haven't got time to hang around. You've got to consider I was quite early having the menopause. I started the menopause at 44.
That's really young,
that
though,
is young.
It?
That is young.
Gosh, it's about 6 years away.
Yes, so...
Quick.
I had no idea my mother was so young when she went through the menopause. I don't suppose it's something you talk about normally. At 44, the number of eggs left in her ovaries had run so low that any chance of a natural pregnancy had virtually gone. If I take after her, it could mean that I have just 6 years to have a family of my own.
For some reason, I just... thought I was invincible, really, and didn't think that there was a cut-off point. But that really hit home. And I just suppose it goes to show that, you know, some people's biological clock ticks for a lot longer than others. And I'm just crossing my fingers that mine ticks for as long as we need it to tick.
Most of us know that as we get older, the number of eggs in our ovaries decreases. But I want to find out exactly how age affects my chances of having a baby. So I'm meeting Professor Tim Child, a consultant in reproductive medicine.
Now, somebody told me, and it scared the living daylight out of me, they said, Alex, do you know that your fertility will literally fall off a cliff after 35? Tell me it's not true.
It's not true. During someone's 20s, about 90-95% of people will get pregnant after a year of trying. I think during early 30s, 85-90%. Later 30s, 75-80% chance of getting pregnant. Oh. The risk of miscarriage does go up. Early 40s, you may be heading down towards 50% chance of getting pregnant over a year.
Mum recently told me that she started going through the menopause at 44, which was a huge shock to me, because that's really early, isn't it?
In the UK, the average age is about 51. So women are born with 2 or 3 million eggs in their ovaries. Mm-hmm. The numbers of eggs are actually not used up by ovulating them. Most of these eggs just die off. So they're not being used, they just die off. And once women get down to a few thousand eggs, then the menopause happens.
And the big question for me, Tim, is, you know, is menopause hereditary?
As with many things, if there's something in the family history, it can increase the chances of it happening to close relatives. Certainly, it can be a risk factor. If someone has had a premature menopause, it could increase the chances for a daughter. But it doesn't mean they will have an earlier menopause.
A bustling city street.
There's no way of knowing if I will follow in my mum's footsteps, but there is a chance I could have an early menopause. So I'm on my way to Hammersmith Hospital to find out how healthy my ovaries are. There are tests available to anyone, no matter what your age. Just ask a GP for them if you're having problems conceiving. And the examination I'm having today could reveal my chances of becoming pregnant. Here goes.
Well, first of all, we do two basic tests. One's a blood test, which looks at your ovarian health in several different ways. The second is an ultrasound scan, which first of all looks at the general gynecological health of the pelvis to see whether there's any ovarian cysts or fibroids present, but also specifically on the fertility side, it looks at what's called the antral follicle count. That tells us if the reserve of eggs is good. So between what we see with the ultrasound and the blood test, that's probably the most powerful predictor of the health of the ovaries that we've got at this stage.
Well, let's start at the beginning then and get some tests done.
Hi there, come in.
Hello.
Hi there.
A blood test will help work out whether or not I'm close to the menopause by checking whether I have a healthy reserve of eggs left.
Do you want to look under the side and think of something nice?
Yes, okay, yeah. I will think of something nice.
Okay, it's all done, yeah.
Thank you very much.
The more eggs that remain inside a woman's ovaries, the further the woman is from the menopause. The eggs develop within cells which produce a hormone called AMH. And it's this hormone that's being tested to see if I have a healthy level. I'm also going to have a more intrusive ultrasound to scan my womb lining and check my ovaries. It should be able to tell me if I'm still maturing a healthy number of between 10 and 30 eggs a month, but could also reveal whether there are any other problems.
The rooftops of London.
Over 1 in 3 women develop fibroids, benign growths in the womb, while around 1 in 7 have polycystic ovary syndrome, a hormonal condition that affects how the ovaries produce eggs. Conditions like these can make becoming pregnant more difficult or impossible, but they can respond to treatment.
Alex walks along a smart street.
I'll have to wait a few days for my results. In the meantime, I want to find out what else I can do to improve my chances of conceiving.
Hello, Zita.
Hi, Alex. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
Well, what a nice office you have, Zita.
Hello.
Midwife Zita West advises couples, especially those in their 30s and 40s, who want to have a baby.
So if Charlie and I came in to see you, what sort of areas would be the first areas we'd be looking at?
Age is the biggest factor, and I think for today's women, they look absolutely fantastic. I mean, you're 38, you don't look 38.
Oh, thank you, Zita.
But it's understanding that your body and your eggs are still, you know, older.
How can we maximise our chances?
Have as much sex as you can.
Lovely.
Really, really important. But also, you know, look, everybody's got a weak area in their lives. So, you know, look at your stress levels. You seem very relaxed and laid back to me, and you also seem very optimistic, which is a good thing. Alcohol, cigarettes, you know, just really cleaning up your lifestyle. Look at your diet and look at the weak areas there. One of the things we do here is we test everybody for vitamin D. You know, vitamin D now is linked to fertility, and many women and men are deficient in vitamin D. So making sure you're getting key nutrients from a wide range of food is really, really important. It's about building your reserves up. You know, to get pregnant, it does require energy, and I'm amazed at some of the couples I see that work really long hours, absolutely running on empty, and they're exhausted.
An initial consultation at Zita's clinic costs £240 and is very comprehensive.
Yeah.
But this kind of information is also available through your GP.
I'd love to. Okay, great.
Luckily, I've always had a pretty healthy diet and enjoyed exercise, although there's always more you can do to improve your overall health. But having a baby is a double act, so I want to discover all I can about male fertility too. My husband Charlie is 37, so is age as important for men as it is for women? And what effect could a man's lifestyle have on his fertility?
Charlie does the cooking. He used to be a chef, so he's a very good cook. It's the only reason I married him. No, it's not. I've read that working in intense heat can actually affect your sperm count. I mean, that was a long time ago, and he's working in an office since I've known him, for about 6 or 7 years now. So it might not be relevant, but it might be. Who knows? It would just be good to get the lowdown on sperm.
A water feature by an imposing period building.
I've come to the University of Sheffield to meet Professor Alan Pacey.
That actually is really nice.
He investigates what can have an impact on sperm quality, and he reckons that age is a crucial factor, which is a new one on me.
Age does affect male fertility, but not quite in the same way that it does in women. So men don't have the equivalent of a menopause.
Right.
But we know that men above the age of 40 are about half as fertile as men under the age of 25.
Really?
They may have the same numbers of sperm, but the quality of the sperm in the 40 or above year olds may be less good at the genetic level compared to the younger chap. And we can see this in many ways. We do detect more miscarriages in women who become pregnant through older men's sperm in comparison to younger men's sperm.
See, that's interesting, because we tend to think of a miscarriage as being the female's problem.
Indeed.
That's the first time I've heard somebody say that.
But there's a lot of evidence now to show that the quality of the sperm has a bearing on how likely a miscarriage is to happen.
There are many factors that affect a man's fertility.
One of the important things that defines whether a man is fertile or not, or whether he produces lots of sperm or not so many sperm, mm-hmm. are the size of his testicles.
Right.
And to illustrate the point, I've actually brought a set of testicle sizing
beads. It's like a necklace.
Beads. It is a little bit like a necklace, isn't
okay.
it? We call this an orchidometer, and this allows a doctor to assess how big a man's testicles are by simply holding it next to the chap's testicles.
That must be a lovely job.
And this is the testicle size you'd expect a young boy to have, but then as he goes through puberty, the size of his testicles will increase, and we would expect that the bigger testicle will be producing more sperm than the little testicle. So if a man's testicles grow to this kind of size, he'll have a much higher sperm production rate than if his testicles grow to this size. And that really is predetermined by his genes and by factors that happened when he was put together as a fetus inside his mother's womb.
I mean, it's common sense, really, I suppose, isn't it? You know,
think about it in terms of car factories.
How big are they and how much can you get in them?
Absolutely. It's like car factories. If you've got a bigger car factory, you'll make more cars per unit time than if you've got a small car factory.
Alan also investigates how a man's sperm can be affected by his lifestyle. And for certain men, changing it could be critical.
there will be some men who have big testicles, who produce lots of sperm, where lifestyle will have a small effect, mm-hmm. but there'll be obviously be some men whose sperm production isn't as good as it could be, and what they then do is damage it further
right.
by doing unhealthy things
okay.
or being in an occupation which is at risk.
To study risk factors linked to lifestyle, Alan is running a series of experiments.
Jacob, nice
hey.
To see you.
How's it going?
Come this way. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Every day, his lab welcomes volunteers who are willing to provide the raw material he needs for his work.
10 microliters on the slide, cover slip, have a look.
Alan has studied sperm samples from over 2,000 men. He judges the health of the sperm by how far and fast they swim.
Right, I'm going to move it along because they've been zipping up here.
He puts some of each volunteer's sperm into a glass tube and measures how many reach the top in 30 minutes.
He studies them under a microscope.
Sperm are much more meandery.
Oh, that's lovely as well.
So far, he's discovered that being exposed to certain chemicals, as painters and decorators or those working in the printing industry can be, could harm sperm quality. Other factors, such as wearing tight underwear, sitting down a lot, or working in a hot environment, can also have a detrimental effect on sperm, because they raise the temperature of the testicles.
A chef at work.
My husband, Charlie, used to be a chef. Mm-hmm. Is that going to cause problems, do you think?
For the duration of time that you're working in that environment, it's possible that your sperm quality or your sperm production will be impaired.
In fact, the ideal temperature for sperm production is around 35 degrees Celsius, a couple of degrees below body temperature. That's why a man's testicles are on the outside. Anything that increases their temperature harms the sperm.
The good news is that risk factors like heat are very reversible, so if you stop the exposure, if you go to another job, then the likelihood is that your sperm production will increase to the point that then is natural for you.
A man keeps producing new sperm throughout his life, and the good news is that anything that harms it only really affects the existing batch. And once that problem's resolved, it should take about 2 or 3 months for the sperm quality to recover.
Babies smiling, crawling, and waving.
So there are some pretty simple things you can do to increase your chances of conceiving, both as a man and a woman. But what if it's not enough?
An infant dozing on a cushion. Then Alex putting on a hairnet and protective shoe coverings.
Millions of people in the UK who struggle with fertility turn to science for help and try a technique like in vitro fertilisation, or IVF. The first IVF baby was born in 1978, after more than 100 attempts with the new technology. Since then, over 6 million IVF babies have been born worldwide. Your chance of having IVF on the NHS depends on how old you are and where you live. It's very variable. If you're under 40, the NHS can provide from none up to 3 cycles. And for those in their early 40s, it could be 1 or none. If you choose to go private, IVF could set you back around £5,000 per cycle.
Okay, Alex, coming through. This is where the magic happens.
Oh, wow.
Dr. Christina Hickman creates under a microscope what usually happens inside a woman's body.
We have a dish like this where we would have the eggs and the sperm inside.
She's working to push IVF science forward.
The important thing is that we're helping these sperm and these eggs get together when they wouldn't naturally be able to do that.
Essentially, this is where life was created in this room.
Pretty much, yes.
In the early 80s, IVF success rates averaged 10%. Today, it's well over 30% for women under 35.
although rates fall as you get older, to about 1 in 10 for women in their early 40s. IVF success rates have been rising constantly as new techniques have been introduced and improved. With ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, sperm can now be injected straight into the egg using a tube the thickness of a hair.
Okay, so this is how the IVF happens.
This helps when sperm quality is poor and they don't easily penetrate the egg.
And the egg still needs to go through the process of accepting the sperm inside. Mm-hmm, but we have improved the odds of it happening by putting them together in the same place.
If the egg is fertilized, the cells will begin to divide and the egg becomes an embryo. However, not every embryo created in the lab will lead on to a successful pregnancy. There may be faults in the embryo's genes, problems with the way it develops, or it may fail at the next stage, which is implanting into the woman's womb. But a recent breakthrough has helped increase chances of picking a healthy embryo to transfer into the womb. A time-lapse camera inside the incubator monitors the embryo while it's growing.
Because it takes pictures every 10 minutes, you can put a video together and you can see the embryo going on from 1 to 2 to 3 cells to 4 cells, and it continues the embryo development.
This allows the team to check constantly whether the embryos are developing correctly and which ones look like the best bet. But in this lab, it's also possible to see some of the reasons it's more difficult to become pregnant as you get older. As you age, it's not just the egg quantity that drops, it's also the egg quality. Some eggs collapse as soon as the sperm is injected because their membrane is too soft, while others develop a tougher membrane over time, making it difficult to be fertilized as it's harder for the sperm to get in.
It's not bursting, so this membrane on the top and the bottom is not letting go.
This one comes from a woman about my age.
So would this egg then be unlikely to fertilize?
This one's less likely to fertilize and less likely to lead on to a baby.
A magnified image of an egg.
Today, it's hit home how fragile our little eggs are and how they do age. This is the ironic thing. We all feel 10 years younger. You know, 40 is the new 25 or new 30. But inside, we're all still the same as we were 100 years ago.
The trend to have babies later means more women are leaving it too late. Their eggs are just unable to be fertilized. And for some, their eggs have virtually run out. But another form of IVF is giving them a real chance to carry a child. And it's now being used to help over 2,000 women in the UK every year.
Cuddly toys in a cot. Then a woman is reading to a young boy.
Daddy tried for a long time to have a baby, but when no baby started to grow, we went to the doctor for help.
Sarah was a sales director at a global company and didn't start trying for a family until she married in her 40s, but she always wanted children.
The doctor said that we couldn't use mummy's eggs.
By then, the condition of her eggs meant she couldn't conceive naturally, so she turned to an IVF technique that doesn't rely on using your own eggs.
Said there's some women who are so kind they want to give one of their eggs to another woman who needs them.
Sarah used eggs donated by a younger woman, and it allowed her to have the child she always wanted.
Hello. How are you? You gone shy?
No.
No. How
this
old
is
are
Alex.
You?
Andre's.
Hello, Andre.
Hi.
Should we shake hands? How old are you, Andre?
Three.
Wow, you're a big boy.
Sarah didn't meet her husband until she was 43.
We tried to have a baby naturally until I then needed to go to the doctor and get a read on what my fertility was like at that age. I had the test done and it was very clear that I had a 2% chance of using my own eggs. And with a donor egg, you have a 60% chance. And for me, it was like, well, a bit of a no-brainer that I can maybe get pregnant and have a baby and become a mother. Something kind of magical about that.
Yeah, I bet. So when you decided that you were going to go for egg donation, how does the process start? I mean, what does it entail?
So what happens is they identify the donor. You know, they create the embryos with my husband's sperm, and then they tell you how many embryos you have, and then you get prepared for those embryos to be placed back. And because I have...
Mommy?
Yes?
This bee.
Oh, no, that's just a little fly. It's fine.
Does it feel strange at all to be carrying an embryo, a baby, essentially, that genetically wasn't created by yourself?
I guess because science even allowed me to carry a baby, I was just, and continue to be, just amazed that I was able to do that.
Sarah needed 5 attempts before an embryo of her husband's sperm and a donor egg was successfully transferred into a womb and implanted there.
How did you feel initially when you had that news and they said, you know, it's worked?
I had just turned 50, like, 2 weeks before. So I kind of knew just naturally that it was coming to its natural conclusion. And they said it's positive, and I just didn't believe it. I just didn't believe it. I still don't believe it.
Sarah is playing with André in a sunny park.
I'm delighted that at 50, science has enabled Sarah to have the child she always wanted. The success rates of IVF with donated eggs average about 40%. They largely depend on the age of the egg donor, and in the UK, all donors have to be under 35. But it comes at a cost. In some areas, the NHS does pay for egg donation. But if not, going private means adding around £2,000 per IVF cycle. And it took Sarah several attempts.
It's been an eye-opener, really, because, you know, my friends and I used to say, well, if nothing works, we'll just do IVF. We thought it was a quick fix solution, really. But what I've learned is that it's really difficult, both emotionally and physically. And actually, the odds are really stacked against you.
The success of IVF with your own or a donor egg depends heavily upon choosing a healthy embryo to transfer into the womb. If the embryo isn't healthy, it won't implant successfully. But an ongoing trial aims to make that critical decision much easier. In Oxford, Professor Tim Child is part of this international trial, which involves screening embryos to check they are genetically healthy and carry the correct number of chromosomes.
When we do a normal IVF cycle, we just look and see which embryos look best, but we've no idea what the genetics are like inside. So the embryologist will choose which embryos look best to put back into the woman's womb.
How many, on average, for, say, a 35-year-old woman would be viable?
Well, incredibly, only around half of embryos that couples make when the woman's in her mid-30s will have the right numbers of chromosomes in. As humans, we're fairly inefficient, actually, at making healthy embryos.
I'm flabbergasted that you've just said that, you know, 50%.
Half, yeah, but that's the reason why the success rate drops off. We know that as women get older, the miscarriage rate goes up significantly, and that's really linked to this. It's linked to these embryos having the wrong numbers of chromosomes. So what we can do is to actually test the genetics of the embryo. It's called pre-implantation genetic screening, and the latest technique is called next-generation sequencing, or NGS. And what we do is actually take away between 2 and 5 of the cells of the embryo from the outside. This is what Danielle's doing here now.
So she's sucking them into this tube here.
So there's a pipette that she's sucking a few cells into. So you can see here a laser is being used to actually separate the cells.
Wow.
A screen shows them being divided.
And what will happen now is those cells will be passed over to the genetics laboratory, and they'll undertake the next generation sequencing of those cells to see that those cells have the right numbers of chromosomes or don't have the right numbers of chromosomes.
The embryos are frozen while Tim waits to find out which ones are normal and do have the correct number of chromosomes. Then he and the embryologist will decide which of those to transfer into the woman's womb. This test is already available privately and costs at least £2,000 on top of the IVF cycle, but it may be offered by the NHS if the trial shows it to be cost-effective.
So, Tim, is it foolproof in terms of if you've had the screening done, is your embryo definitely healthy and will definitely implant, or sometimes does it just not work for however many other reasons?
So we know that if we find an embryo who's got the right numbers of chromosomes in and it's an otherwise healthy-looking embryo, when we put that back, the chance of it implanting is between 60 and 70%.
Wow.
So it's not 100%. But it's certainly much higher than just a random embryo. And the reasons why it's not 100% would be there are many other things that could affect why embryos implant or not.
So even if doctors select a genetically viable embryo to transfer, there's still over a 30% chance that it won't implant successfully in the womb.
An airport in Valencia.
But in the Spanish city of Valencia, a team has made a discovery about the timing of the transfer. Dr. Carla Simon hopes it will help transform implantation success rates.
We have calculated that one in four patients with implantation failure, the reason is because we are not doing the transfer of the embryos at the right time for the patient.
One couple he's helping are Maite and Julio. They're both in their early 40s and have spent over 5 years having IVF. But Maite's womb keeps rejecting the embryos.
We made several attempts that didn't work, she explains. And each time it didn't work, it affected us badly. Yes, it's, let's say it's painful, Julio adds.
Carlos believes there is just one optimum chance for the embryo to be transferred into the womb.
This is a window of opportunity, just a few hours in every woman, and this is not the same time in each patient. And synchronization is crucial.
Right.
If we transfer the embryos at the wrong time, they will not be able to attach to the mother's womb.
Carlos gives each woman a bespoke combination of hormones to help prepare her womb. He then takes a tiny tissue sample from the womb to make sure that it's at its most receptive by testing the individual characteristics of the cells that make up the womb lining.
This is personalized medicine. And by transferring the embryos at the right time, this patient implant and have healthy child.
4 months ago, Carlos used this technique to choose the right time to transfer an embryo into Maite's womb.
This is going to be the little head, Carlos explains. Here's the umbilical cord. The day we found out we were pregnant, you didn't believe it. Julio smiles. I kept checking that they were the right results. And in the end, they assured us it was true. She was pregnant. The start of a beautiful dream. Look, the baby's starting to move. Carlos observes while studying a scan. Starting to move by itself. Now let's see if we can hear it. The couple share a kiss. It's great joy because we really weren't expecting it, but it's true.
Perfecto, perfecto. Muy bien.
This treatment is currently only available in a handful of clinics around the world, but Carlos hopes it will one day be available to everyone, improving the chances of having a baby for women of all ages.
Passing over buildings and landmarks along the River Thames.
Science is constantly pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
Alex is driving.
But for a few women, the odds are so stacked against them. They're told they'll never carry a baby of their own. Like Jenny.
So when did you first think that there might be a problem then, Jen?
I think I was probably about
15, 16, and I had to go and have an ultrasound because I was having some abdominal pain. And I was called in to see one of the consultants who sort of sat in front of me and looked at me in a certain way, and I thought, oh, there's really something wrong here, and you get that feeling in your stomach.
Yeah.
And then she said, I don't really know what to tell you. You have a condition called MRKH, and you were born without a womb. I remember saying to her, so does that mean I can't have children? And she shrugged and said, I really don't know what I can say.
And that was it? No further support, no advice?
No. I felt like the world had dropped out. And I went and locked myself in the bathroom and sat on the floor and just cried and cried.
And how do you feel now then, you know, nearly 30?
Yeah.
Is a family something you want?
Eventually.
Have you thought about the options that are open to you then?
Women with MRKH actually are quite lucky in a way because we're born with ovaries and eggs, and some women don't have that.
No.
So we are able to have our own biological children, we just can't carry them.
No.
So there's agencies in the UK that can link you up with women that are interested in being surrogates. So I'm lucky enough that I have two older sisters who have both said that they'd love to do it.
An operation is underway.
So let's start over here.
4 years ago, Swedish surgeon Mats Brandström made an extraordinary breakthrough that could transform the lives of people like Jenny. He became the first person in the world to successfully transplant a womb from one woman to another. A 61-year-old woman gave her womb to a family friend. That pioneering operation has led to 6 more transplants and 5 healthy babies so far.
Snow-covered streets.
Jenny now runs a support group for women without wombs, and she's come to Sweden to find out more about this new technique.
So this is actually the story about the first baby, and I delivered the baby myself, and this was a very special moment.
Yeah.
And to hear the first cry and so on. And so, of course, that's something I will always remember.
Yeah.
Today he's 1.5 years almost, and he walks, and he's a very happy baby.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So obviously there's lots of women back home that are really excited about this sort of step forward in treatment. So if I go home and the women and the girls say to me, is this something that's going to be an option for me in the future, what would you recommend that I say?
If it comes into clinic, which I'm sure it's going to be, I think it's going to be a routine procedure in 5 to 10 years in many, many countries around the world, and of course including UK, because you've done a lot of research in the UK and you're now starting your first trial, so definitely.
Hello.
Hi.
Mats has arranged for Jenny to meet Cash, his fourth womb transplant baby, along with Cash's father, Patrick.
You're beautiful, aren't you?
Womb transplants could help thousands of British women in the future.
Do you want a cuddle?
Even though I know that that's not going to be the road that I'll go down, it's the girls in my support group that will potentially be able to benefit from it, which is fantastic because, you know, they might get this, and that's amazing because I don't want them to have to go through what I've been through.
He is solid.
To be able to see someone else who has gone through what I've gone through and yet had the magic wand that I wanted.
She sniffs and glances skywards.
It's amazing.
Oh, he's so soft and warm.
From Jenny with the baby in her arms to a bird's eye view of sprawling central London, then mothers and children in a playground.
Jenny's story makes me all too aware that carrying a child is still not something anyone can take for granted, despite the extraordinary research happening right across the globe.
It occurred to me that I never consider the possibility that I wouldn't have children one day, which is really naive, especially knowing what we know now.
But that's changed. I do now realise it's something I might have to face. Today, I'm going to hear the results of my fertility tests to find out how my ovaries are doing and whether I've got a healthy reserve of eggs left.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well. So starting first of all on the ultrasound side, the ultrasound shows there's no significant cyst in the ovaries at all, which straight away is very reassuring.
Well, that's... Yes.
We then come on to the fertility aspects.
Yeah.
So the ultrasound measurement, the antral follicle count, that came out to be a total of 12.
That means that about 12 eggs were maturing in my ovaries when I had the scan.
So for your age, that is absolutely fine, with no concerns at all. We then look at the blood test. Yours has come out at 14.8.
This is the level of the AMH hormone in my blood that indicates how many eggs I have left in my ovaries and whether or not I'm close to the menopause.
You're in the very healthy range there.
Oh, great.
I'd be reassured, not worried, about the health of the ovaries.
That's very good news. Well, I'm really relieved. It was really unnerving to be faced with it suddenly, and therefore I've got every sympathy with any couple or individual who are having a difficult time of it. Yeah, it's a big thing.
Children being pushed on swings.
I know now there are no guarantees when it comes to getting pregnant. There are so many things at play, and the tests I've had have only shown me a few of those.
Alex walks past the playground.
I mean, Dr. True said everything was okay, but I know that that is for a woman of my age, and my eggs really aren't getting any younger. This process has been brilliant, though, because I've learned so much, and I now feel that I've got the right information to maximise my chances. So I really hope that we can start our own family pretty soon.
8 months later, The One Show on September the 2nd, 2016.
Just so happens that my husband and I, Charlie and I, are having a baby. Yay! And lots of you had guessed, and I was trying to breathe in, and eventually I can breathe out, which is just lovely.
Well, it's fantastic news. We've got a new One Show baby on the way, and we are so thrilled for
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
When I started filming this documentary, I had no idea how things would turn out for us. But luckily, it was a straightforward process, and of course, we are thrilled to be having a baby. But what I've learned is how precarious conception can be. It can be a heartbreaking process, both emotionally and financially. But we've met some really inspiring people, and it's been amazing to see what science can do. And I really hope it can help everybody, no matter what their circumstances, to have a family.